Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXVIII, Cornelia, Mother of the Gracchi. What we do know about Cornelia is mostly through the lens of her famous sons. But to the Romans, she was much more than that. She was put on a pedestal, in bronze form no less, as the ideal mother for Roman women to aspire to, and may have been quite influential in politics in her time. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Cornelia was an elite, an aristocratic Roman woman, known to be very educated, often brought out as the ideal exemplar of a virtuous Roman woman. We don't know exactly when she was born, sometime between 195 and 190 BC. Mm-hmm. So we don't know too much about her young life, but she really comes to prominence because of people she's related to and the family that she marries into and her offspring.
Mm-hmm. So predictably.
I guess so. The very fact that she's an elite woman means that she's in a position to be more prominent anyway, but there are plenty of elite Roman Republican women that we don't know about.
Mm.
She's born into a very notable family because she is the daughter, or the younger daughter, of Scipio Africanus, who was the general who defeated Hannibal in the Second Punic War.
Mm-hmm.
That's already an incredibly prominent family. He's considered a military genius, Scipio. People still study his tactics. And she marries into the family of the Gracchi. So she marries Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, who himself had an illustrious career, being consul twice.
Yes.
He had about 12 years between his consulships. And he had celebrated two triumphs, which is no mean feat. Some people think this is a bit strange because her father and the Gracchi family, I should say the Gracchus family, her father, Scipio.
What's the plural of a Gracchi?
And the Gracchan family.
The Gracchan.
I'm trying to make it an adjective. So her father, Scipio, and the Gracchan family were ideologically quite opposed. Now, it's true that she got married after the death of her father, but it seems to have been arranged or approved of by her father before he died.
Mm.
We're told by Plutarch, who's one of the main sources for what we know about Cornelia. He writes biographies of two of her sons. He says, although they had not been friends, in other words, her father and Gracchus,
yes,
he was deemed worthy to marry her. He's a man of worth.
And there's still currency in marrying the daughter of Scipio Africanus after he's passed away.
Oh, absolutely. Remember, the Republic is basically ruled by an oligarchy, a kind of cabal of elite Roman families.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those families are up there. So they are appropriate families to marry into one another.
Yeah, yeah. So as you've alluded, one of the very few sources that we have that talks about her is Plutarch. But even then, passing mentions, really. She is a side story in the story of her sons.
Well, she's very significant for Plutarch and for others in the story of the Gracchi.
Mm.
But yes, it's true. As with other cases, we don't get a biography of Cornelia. And this is something that we're always up against. Plutarch doesn't write any biographies of women. Suetonius doesn't write biographies of women. So the way we get to know about the women is they're related to men that have biographies written about them. This is the reason we don't know much about her early life. We know about her when her life involves being important in the lives of Tiberius or Gaius Gracchus, her sons.
Yes. One of the main early mentions that Plutarch does have is regarding her marriage to Tiberius. I love these prophecies that always come up at the start.
Very folktale-ish.
Yes.
I love it too. So this is in chapter one of Tiberius Gracchus, because this is about his early life and his parents.
Mm-hmm.
We are told, moreover, that he once, and this is Tiberius Gracchus the father.
The elder?
Yes. He once caught a pair of serpents on his bed, and that the soothsayers, after considering the prophecy, forbade him to kill both serpents or to let both go, but to decide the fate of one or the other of them, declaring also that the male serpent, if killed, would bring death to Tiberius, and the female to Cornelia. I have to say, living in Australia, I think people wouldn't be hanging around for soothsayers, would they? They'd
yeah,
kill both of them, probably.
It's like, I found these two snakes, call the soothsayers. Not the first thing that comes to mind.
That snakes are really important in kind of Greco-Roman mythology and mystical spheres.
Yes.
So the story continues. Tiberius, accordingly, who loved his wife,
which I think is quite significant.
It's apparently unusual enough to need comment, and thought that since she was still young and he was older, which again is a typical pairing in antiquity, it was more fitting that he should die. He killed the male serpent, but let the female go.
I mean, that makes it all about Tiberius, but this says a lot about their marriage, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, and according to the story, a short time afterwards, he died, yes, leaving Cornelia with 12 children by him.
Yeah, that's rough.
So, you know, fortunate she was an elite woman with a lot of health.
Yeah.
12 children, wow.
Yeah.
So she must be at least in her late 20s, I would assume somewhere in her 30s by this point.
Mm.
And he's considerably older, apparently. It's not just Plutarch who mentions this. It's also there in Cicero. And clearly, it's a well-worn kind of folk tale. It becomes mythic, as it were, about the life of Cornelia. It does tell us a lot about attitudes towards her, because for all I've already made a snide remark about how it was unusual for a husband to love his wife in Roman antiquity.
They're arranged marriages.
They're arranged. They don't have to come from a basis of love. But the Roman ideal was absolutely that it should be a loving marriage.
Yeah.
The fact that it didn't always happen was not great in Roman eyes. So that's what they hoped for. They hoped for this mutual affection and support. And this is an early sign of Cornelia being that ideal figure.
Mm.
She's also been very fruitful. She has had 12 children. And as we'll see, this is going to be extremely tragic because she will outlive all of them.
She becomes known to us through her children, though. But it's also said something quite a lot about the life at the time that of the 12 children, 3 survived to adulthood.
Yeah.
That is terrible odds. The two that we, of course, know is Tiberius Gracchus and Gaius Gracchus, and a daughter called Sempronia.
Yes.
Pliny was also quite amazed by the fact that she managed to alternate the gender of each child.
Yeah. I'm not completely convinced that Pliny would have known the exact order of her children's births, given that only 2 of them become very famous and only 3 of them even got to adulthood. But maybe, I mean, maybe it was just chance, presumably, if she did have boy, girl, so on.
So really, from this point, she becomes known and always described as mother of, doesn't she? She's quite involved in the upbringing of her children, and that seems to become, as far as we know, a focal point of her life.
Yes, as we'll discuss, she becomes mythified as this figure who is the perfect mother. She's left without a husband. She dedicates herself to her children. And 2 of them are going to become very prominent, so she's known through them. And she is known as Cornelia of the Gracchi, mother of the Gracchi, which is quite unusual nomenclature in that normally you continue to be known by one of your father's names.
I was about to say, especially the daughter of Scipio Africanus.
Yeah, yeah. So Cornelia Africana is a name that we see attached to her, but it's not the most common one. Cornelia of the Gracchi, much more prominent. And the reason there is really spelled out or summed up by Plutarch when he says that having been left with these children, she showed herself so discreet, so good a mother, and so magnanimous that Tiberius was thought to have made no bad decision when he elected to die instead of such a woman.
Mm.
I suspect the whole thing is nonsense, but it's a great story.
It's just myth-making.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So despite the fact that there would still be currency in being married to such a woman?
Oh, absolutely.
She remains a widow.
She does. And this gives her more status as well. Now, this is really paradoxical in Roman society, because if she were still technically under the protection, as it were, under the authority of her father, but remember her father had died before her marriage,
yeah,
then he might well have stepped in and married her to somebody else, which might make for a good dynastic, as it were, marriage for his family. But as a widow, she's technically got more freedom than any woman ever has in Roman society, especially a widow whose father is no longer around.
Yes.
Because she gets liberated by this. The benefit of remaining a widow is that it gives you this cultural status as what the Romans called an uni vero, a once married woman. And you can tell from the fact that they had a word for it that it wasn't that usual. All the women we know of, all the prominent women, were married. They might die before they could marry again, especially in childbirth. They might survive their husband and then they would usually be married again. Or they might well be divorced and remarried, sometimes several times.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, divorce is very common in antiquity, and for the Romans it wasn't shameful. Because of this, and because it was so rare, the Romans really prized this uni vera. It means a one-man woman, literally. It's prized by the Romans because it hardly ever happens. And what it shows is that she was entirely dedicated to her husband and to their children. She kind of doesn't need to marry again because she's already got the offspring.
Mm. But it isn't without getting offers, is it?
Some people are skeptical of this, but famously, she is supposed to have turned down a marriage proposal from a king, from Ptolemy VIII Physcon of Egypt. So she could have been queen of Egypt.
She could have been. That sort of marriage proposal wouldn't have been common. So.
No, it's true. I mean, it shows the circles that she moves in and how highly she's considered that this, even if it's not true, the fact that it becomes something that's repeated says a lot about her and how she's regarded. So instead of taking on a possible proposal like that, she dedicates herself to her children, which is another reason that she's seen as this great woman.
Yeah.
And specifically dedicates herself to their education. Which might seem quite surprising if you know about education in ancient Rome, that boys tend to get more education than girls. Mm-hmm. But Cornelia herself had been very well educated, clearly, and she regarded her children's education as very important too. And in fact, we do get ideas from elsewhere that a Roman mother is considered important in her son's education. That she kind of has control over that, that she might well steer them in the right direction. I mean, it's much, much later, but Tacitus in 98 CE, he says that his father-in-law, who grew up in the province, was directed by his mother to learn a little bit of philosophy, but not too much, because too much would have tipped him over into, you know, thinking too much. Doing that Greek stuff is the idea.
Agricola?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's in the Agricola. Yeah. Well done. So they're
she's surprised. Yeah. 5 years of a podcast and something sinks in.
We haven't done a podcast on him yet, have
no, we?
We
haven't.
We need
no.
to, though.
Okay. You just said it.
So the mother in education amongst elite Romans is actually quite a natural fit for them.
Yeah.
Her involvement in it. And this is one of the reasons that she gets a lot of praise. And it's not surprising that she's interested in education either, because she's been brought up in the Scipionic household and they're really interested in new forms of knowledge, you know, in finding out about Greek culture and in immersing themselves in Greek literature and philosophy.
Mm.
So she's surrounded by this. Her family tend to be patrons of literary types. She kind of transfers this on to the next generation.
This comes out in her interests now, doesn't it? It's almost like, you know, she's now got some free time to do what she wants now that she's her own woman.
I guess so. And she can actually direct what's going on. I mean, she's supposed to have brought Greek scholars who were in Rome into her household. So philosophers like Blossius from Cumae, which is a Greek area of Italy, and Diophanes from Mytilene. She invites them into her house to talk to and help to educate her children. So they're getting absolutely the best education that any money can buy. Tacitus in this work, The Dialogus, which is a dialogue about how oratory is terrible now under the emperors. All right, so the ability to speak and to write good speeches has gone right downhill. One of the speakers in this dialogue claims that public speaking was better when children were brought up by their mothers. He compares it to now where their education is just farmed out to slaves.
Yeah.
And the examples he gives for this excellent education, number one is Cornelia. So her sons are well educated. The other two examples he gives are the mothers of Julius Caesar and Augustus. And all three of them are widowed. So they're all in a position to take over this responsibility.
Ah, okay.
But he's giving that position, or at least one of Tacitus' speakers, is giving that position to mothers like Cornelia.
Yeah. Espousing the benefit of being a widow, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so. By implication.
Another example of her very much being her own woman at this stage, I suppose, is an example we get about the way she dresses.
This story is both lovely and kind of sickening. This is meant to be when some of her female friends are talking, they're kind of bragging about their jewelry and their clothing. Mm. And Cornelia, for a woman of her rank, presumably is dressed relatively simply, or certainly she's not interested in showing off, in having showy clothing. This is, by the way, part of a whole debate on how much women should be allowed to wear colourful and showy clothing. And at various times, the Romans brought in laws to say they couldn't ride around in golden carriages or something like that.
Yeah.
So this is a concern that comes up every now and again during the Republic. This is from Valerius Maximus, not someone we often quote. He's an early imperial Roman writer. He says that when women friends questioned Cornelia about her mode of dress and personal adornment, which was far more simple and understated than was usual for a wealthy Roman woman of her rank and station, Cornelia indicated her sons and said, "These are my jewels," prizing her children above glittery things.
Yeah.
These other women are by implication trivial.
Yes.
And kind of grasping, I guess, because they want all of this glitzy stuff, whereas she is more interested in mothering her children. It's a bit cloying in a way, isn't it? It's slightly overstated, I guess. It's a tale that has probably kind of grown by accretion just because Cornelia is seen as this good mother.
Yes.
We should also say that Plutarch doesn't pick up on this story.
Mm.
But either he doesn't trust it, or maybe he thinks like me that it's just a bit too...
Bit too on the nose?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about her involvement in the politics of her son. Plural. Sons.
Yeah.
Which, I hate to say it, is how we mostly know her as an extension of her sons. So just kind of nutshell who her sons are and why they are prominent.
Yeah, well, we're going to be looking at Tiberius and Gaius.
And when I say nutshell, I'm a nut. How did I get in this shell? Real nutshell.
They're both prominent as popular leaders who become tribunes of the people, tribunes of the plebs, try to introduce quite radical, particularly property laws. They're very popular with some people, but
We're now out of the nutshell.
Yeah. Okay. They both get murdered as a result of these policies. So what they try and do is quite radical. Many people say that their view of the world is influenced by their upbringing by Cornelia. It's more use of Cornelia. They use Cornelia in their speeches quite often. So they make use of her as supposedly already this idealized figure. So she can work for them if these speeches are in fact genuine.
Yeah.
They largely come from Plutarch. So, for example, the younger son Gaius had removed a law that disgraced a man called Marcus Octavius, the tribune whom Tiberius had deposed. So there's a whole rivalry going on here.
Yeah.
And he did it supposedly because Cornelia asked him to remove it. So that implies that she's having a direct influence on policy here. That she's involved in lawmaking that Gaius can actually carry out.
I wonder what her stake in that was.
It's not more explicit than that. Yeah. I don't think we know more about it. So it's pretty clear that if we believe Plutarch, then both the Gracchi, both the sons, were using Cornelia's reputation in order to make very rhetorical and persuasive speeches.
Mm.
And often, according to Plutarch, in response to negatives that might have been said about them. He says, "There are on record also many things which Gaius said about her in the coarse style of forensic speech." So in other words, in politics and in the law courts, you could get away with insulting people, is what he means, when he was attacking one of his enemies. "What," he said, "are you abusing Cornelia who gave birth to Tiberius?" So she gave birth to my brother. How dare you?
Yeah.
"And since the one who had uttered the abuse was charged with effeminate practices," so he was seen as a bit soft, the word in Greek is malakos, he said, "with what effrontery can you compare yourself to Cornelia? Have you borne such children as she did?" It's a strange thing to say to a man, but remember, he's already been described as soft.
Yes.
"And verily, all Rome knows that she refrained from commerce with men longer than you have, though you are a man." So he's playing on a couple of things here. He's saying, how dare you insult me and insult my mother, indeed. He doesn't actually say she's Cornelia at that point. She's this important ideal woman.
You should know who she is, though.
Yeah, you should know who she is. She's the mother of my brother Tiberius.
Yes.
There is actually a slightly different version of this quoted by Seneca, which is a bit more self-centered, where he says that Gaius says, "You slander my mother who gave birth to me." All right. So I think the one where he says, "Are you insulting Cornelia who gave birth to Tiberius?" is seen as a little less egotistical. It might have moved it slightly away. So there's that. All right. She's important because she had this really significant guy as her son. She brought him up. How dare you insult her? But then he carries on having a go at this man through Cornelia. And in this very complicated way, the Romans often attacked people, especially men, for supposedly being sexually inadequate or sexually deviant, as they saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to him, look, you're in this position where you're soft. You're encouraging men to have sex with you. You haven't born any children, and she did, so she's better than you.
Mm.
Also, not only did she do that, so she did her job as a woman by having children, but then after she's widowed, she's remained chaste all these years, and you haven't even remained chaste.
That's a complicated put
it's
down.
It's a very but it's making use of all of the advantages he can get from a mother like Cornelia in
yes.
there. She's born lots of children. She hasn't remarried. She has that univira status. So that's how she is useful to them as an exemplar in this speech. I agree. It is complicated. But you can see how other mothers might not have been so useful to political figures like Gaius.
It's interesting that both those examples as well are from the life of Gaius Gracchus.
Mm.
So I wonder if this status she got, which is clearly in these instances after Tiberius has died, are as the result of being the mother of essentially a martyr, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, that's not ever made completely clear. And something we should bear in mind, I don't want to pour cold water on that because I quite like that idea,
yeah.
is that Plutarch himself is writing, you know, 250 years later, over 200 years later.
Yes.
And she has kind of amassed this almost cult status by then.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible that this was said at the time. There might be an accretion of additional information being added in.
So by the time that Plutarch was writing about her, there seems to be a definite kind of myth element to her. And that only became more apparent as time went on. So how did Romans use her as a bit of a myth, a bit of a symbol?
Well, Plutarch tells us that there was a statue erected of her,
mm.
which is really rare for a Roman woman to have this public presence. So again, in the life of Gaius, the people were pleased and honoured Cornelia no less on account of her sons than because of her father. Indeed, in after times, that's nice and vague, isn't it?
Mm.
They erected a bronze statue of her bearing the inscription Cornelia, Mother of the Gracchi. As I say, extremely unusual to have a public statue of a woman in this period, almost unknown during the Republic, where women just don't appear as public figures.
Yeah.
So that gives her a very special status. Unfortunately, Plutarch is not very clear about when this happened. It might not have been long after.
Yeah.
It might have been decades after. Certainly, we do have a statue base which bears her name, which is now in the Capitoline Museum.
But that doesn't say that, does it?
It doesn't say exactly that. And it's a very complicated story to the inscription. It says Cornelia Africana of the Gracchi.
Mm.
So Cornelia Africana Gracchorum, it is of the Gracchi, which is a strange way of talking about a Roman woman, actually. I mean, in all of this, her fame that she gets through her children is quite counter to the way Romans normally think, which is it comes from the father. For women, their name comes from their father. She sort of gets this epithet from her sons. It's not from her husband because it's plural,
yeah.
of the Gracchi, not of Gracchus.
Okay.
Sometimes women, not often, but sometimes they are wife of, but much more normally they're daughter of. So she's got the Africana bit here, at least in this inscription. But the inscription itself is a bit awkward because it seems to be stylistically, in the way that it's written, from the Severan period, which is a lot later.
So altered to reflect the Africanus?
Well, that's one theory. That's one theory.
Yeah.
I mean, the other possibility, which is not as attractive, but we kind of have to take it into account, is it's not even the same statue. There might have been more than one. There were probably copies made. Bronze is expensive and you might make copies in marble or something like that. Also, it's quite possible that Plutarch got the inscription slightly wrong. So mundane things like that.
How dare you?
I guess you'd have to do a bit more of a detailed exploration about whether in the Severan period they might have thought that not having her father's name on it was just wrong. So that's why they put Africana there. I think what we can't deny is that Cornelia is still an ideal figure, an exemplary mother, an exemplary woman, hundreds of years later. Otherwise, why bother putting the inscription there at all?
So lastly, we've got records of her being a writer, and we've potentially got some of her writings, but regardless, we know that she wrote.
We do, because Cicero talks about what a great writer she was. He says her style was very beautiful.
Yes. coming from Cicero.
Well, I know, high praise, huh? Yeah. And we do have two excerpts, two fragments, as it were, of letters that Cornelius is supposed to have written to Gaius the year before he was killed, so in 122 BCE, kind of giving him advice, supposedly. Now, these appear in the writings of a biographer called Nepos, Cornelius Nepos, who's a first century BC writer. But most ancient historians think that these are not genuine fragments at all, that Cornelia didn't write them.
I'd be interested in your thoughts you would come up with such a...
Yeah. Well, if people want to look at the whole fragments, and they're not very long, then I would direct them to the Diotima site, D-I-O-T-I-M-A, where Marilyn Skinner's translation is up there.
Yeah.
And that's what I'll be reading from. The interesting thing about these extracts, especially the longer one, is that they give us a Cornelia who really objects to the revolutionary turn that Tiberius and Gaius have taken, particularly directing this at Gaius after his brother has been murdered. And she's talking about the pain that it's caused her and how she's so annoyed with him. So, for example, no enemy has given me as much vexation and pain as you have in this affair. You who should have assumed the roles of the children I once had. So he's the only one left.
Jeez, no pressure, guys.
Yeah. She starts that out with, I would swear a solemn oath that apart from those who slew Tiberius Gracchus, no one's caused me more misery than you, basically. So you're almost as bad as the people who murdered my son. Jeez. Lovely.
Wow.
And she says that, a bit later in this, or supposedly says, so you can't be of service for even the short length of time without going against my will and destroying the state. So she's saying that his policies are destroying the state, which directly contradicts the idea that we have elsewhere, that she almost directs some of his policies, encouraging him to pass particular laws. And this is the only place we see any mention of this. Plutarch does not make any mention of her objecting to what Tiberius and Gaius are doing, which is one reason why people don't put a lot of stock into these quotes. They're not mentioned anywhere else, so there's nothing to back this up, despite the fact that Cornelia appears all over the place. Also, this comes from a position, I don't know if it's from Nepos or one of his sources, of somebody who does themselves object to what Tiberius and Gaius were doing. They don't like this kind of populist move, but they want Cornelia to still be an idealized woman. So for this to add up, she must have objected to what they were doing. I think that's where it must come from, that they kind of want one version of Cornelia, but they don't want her to approve of her children.
The argument for it being something real would be that, hey, look, it's her trying to influence her son's decision making, which we've got slight record of happening in Plutarch. But I guess if it's anti-Gracchi propaganda, they would want to put out the thing that, look, even your own mother was against what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think for a while there was a desire, I mean, we kind of want it to be genuine, so we have some writing by a woman.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's the only other shame kind of thing.
Yeah.
If it's not real.
It's kind of tragic that there's very little chance that these are Cornelia's words, because we'd love to have some.
The other main instance that we know about Cornelia comes upon the death of her sons, and I suppose the grief that an ideal Roman woman should express upon the death of their child. What are we told then from the sources?
She becomes a really useful exemplar for people like Seneca the Younger, who's a Stoic, because she's supposed to have had very restrained grief and kind of talked about her pride rather than her sorrow. And this is very, very rhetorical, kind of overblown statements, what we might call sententious, very pithy. Seneca loves the fact that he can talk about her and admire her remarkable retort to those who had tried to console her, to whom she replied with grave cheerfulness, apparently, I will never call myself unlucky, I who gave birth to the Gracchi. It's actually from a work of consolation that Seneca's writing to a friend called Marcia, whose son has died. I think it's actually quite tactless of Seneca, because Marcia's son has died quite young and hasn't been able to make his mark on the world yet.
But still, yep. Seneca's telling her how to grieve.
I guess he's putting her up as an example. It's hard not to say, see the positives in this. Yes, see the positives in your child dying. I mean, it's horrible, isn't it?
Mm.
But it is part of that mythification of Cornelia. She's very restrained and she prefers to feel pride in her sons. And also it really fixes her position, her whole identity as being the mother of the Gracchi. That's what makes her famous. That's where she draws her fame from.
Mm.
And she's great for the Stoics because this is part of their dogma that you shouldn't just give way to grief. You shouldn't indulge in your sorrow. And so Cornelia is sort of a poster girl for them.
Perhaps appropriately, given that we know nothing about her outside of who she's the mother of, we know nothing about her after the death of Gaius, really.
No. So she's supposed to have retired further south in Italy to a place called Misenum, on the Bay of Naples, you know, one of those places that rich Romans do retire to.
Yeah.
And it's also a Greek-influenced area, so I guess that fits with her having been highly educated.
Mm.
And yet we don't know exactly when she dies. So she kind of slips away, you're right, after all of her children have died. I think that what really sums Cornelia up is the very first time we know of that she gets called Mother of the Gracchi, which is in Cicero, where he's praising her as an educationalist. This is in Cicero's Brutus, which is a dialogue about oratory, Brutus 2:11. It matters greatly whom each person hears every day at home, with whom he speaks from boyhood on, how fathers and pedagogues and even mothers speak. I have read the letters of Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi. It is patent that her sons were raised less in their mother's lap than in her speech. Cicero could have no greater praise, I think.
That's Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. As always, they are very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Tiberius Gracchus tries to make the state a better place for the common people. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.